From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Akeem Olajuwon, one of basketball's most popular players. Tonight, his team, the Houston Rockets, go against the LA Lakers as they continue their 3-5 series in the NBA playoffs. We'll talk with Olajuwon about growing up in Nigeria. He didn't even pick up a basketball until he was 17. Also today, the gap between the salaries of CEOs and workers is larger than ever. Is what's good for the CEO good for the company or good for the economy? We'll hear from two people with two different points of view. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the various euphemisms for you're fired, and David Bianculli tells us about the newest cable channel, Nick at Night's TV Land, which premieres tonight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of the most popular basketball players today, Akeem Olajuwon. Tonight, his team, the Houston Rockets, goes against the Los Angeles Lakers in the NBA playoffs. They're tied 1-1 in a best-of-five series. Last year, Olajuwon became the first player in NBA history to, in one season, win Most Valuable Player for the regular season, Defensive Player of the Year, and the NBA Finals MVP. That's especially remarkable considering Olajuwon's personal story, which he tells in his new autobiography. Olajuwon grew up in Nigeria. He didn't play basketball. In fact, he didn't even see the game played until he was 17. Soon after he started playing, he came to the University of Houston on a scholarship, where he learned to play American basketball while he learned about American life. I asked him his very first impressions of basketball when he saw it played in Lagos, Nigeria.
Well, I liked it right away, because it was fascinating when I first saw a point guard that was handling the basketball, dribbling between his leg without looking at the ball. So that was amazing to me just to see that. So I questioned myself, how can he do that? He was dribbling the ball without looking at the ball between his legs. So I thought that was so cool.
So how did you get to play?
Well, I was a handball and also a soccer player, but the basketball coaches, you know, often, come up to me and invite me to play basketball, saying to me that basketball is your sport. All the other sports that you're playing right now is not for you. Basketball is really your game. So finally, they invited me to the game one time just to watch, and it was so competitive. And I really enjoyed the game that I feel like, you know, I wanted to play basketball.
Now, was the American connection to basketball appealing to you?
Yes. You know, this is American sports. And you see the people, even people in the crowd watching the game, who they were wearing all kind of different T-shirts of different universities in America, like UCLA, University of Alabama, Kentucky, you know, things like that. So it was. You see a whole different people that have traveled overseas that came back home, just still have the love for the sports.
Well, you say in your book that when you were growing up, it was the goal of most of the Nigerian students that you knew to study abroad.
Yes, that has been the goal for many, for a long time. The elder generation used to go to England. Then the new, like my set, my age group, start looking, coming to America.
Did you want to go to America?
Yeah, of course.
Why?
to study. And also, since I pick up basketball also, that's another incentives that I can really get a chance to play basketball and also go to school.
Now, why did you want to go to America?
I mean, that's the goal of all the students, the privilege. Coming to America, getting your degree, and when you go back home, your job is already, there's no competition, and they put you in a very high position. So that has been the goal. That has been the goal for every successful businessman in Nigeria.
Now, what are the things, what were the American things that you loved most growing up in Nigeria? What were the things that were considered really cool?
Well, just you know, you hear about this great country, you know, where, you know, they produce the best candidate of different in technology, in sports, in, you know, the freedom of speech. Just this great country that is so advanced, and they take the head start toward any new innovation in the world. And especially for myself, but because of my height in Nigeria, you know, I was so, you know, I'm too tall than the normal people, where I feel abnormal, not really comfortable growing up. And they say, well, in America, you feel so comfortable because they admire tall people, where in Nigeria, tall people were being criticized, or people making fun, making different jokes about it, you know, being tall. Where in America, they say they appreciate heights and things like that. So I look forward just to be in a country where I really feel comfortable and feel like I belong.
One of the coaches in Africa who was American recommended that you study abroad. He helped you get a basketball scholarship and a visa. What did your parents think about you leaving to play basketball?
Well, first of all, this was a basketball scholarship at the University of Houston, you know, under consideration of basketball, you know, as a student. So my sister went to school in American University in Cairo, in Egypt. And my parents, they send the money every year for school fees, and they know how expensive, you know, it was for them to support my sister. Now it was my turn to travel abroad, and I don't think they were able to afford two students abroad. But just the consideration of a scholarship motivated them that this is a blessing from God, that they don't have to pay for my school fees if I can get a scholarship.
Early on in America, you got into fights on the court. And you say that your idea of somebody picking a fight was really different from everybody else's. If you saw somebody walking too close to you, they were in your face, and in your mind, they were picking a fight. Would you explain the difference to us between the American sense and your sense of what was going too far?
You see, in Nigeria, you know, Lagos is, you have to be street smart. And I've seen people knocked out in different ways. Like, for example, somebody will walk up to you like you're having an argument, but he's looking for an opportunity. He can just headbutt you and knock your teeth out of your mouth. Or somebody can walk up to you in a very calm, everything is okay, and just strike, you know, a blow, and knock people's, you know, knock you down completely, you know, where they have to rush people to the hospital. So during my early years in my career in the NBA, when players walk up to me, I don't trust them. You know, if you want to talk, then you talk from distance. Then I know there's peace. But when you walk close to talk, then once you walk past certain line, then I have to strike first because I don't trust you. You know, because you're not walking towards me to make peace. You come in for confrontation, and I don't trust you. So I'll be the first one to strike if you walk, you know. It's either you stop and we discuss it from distance. Once you walk close, that means you're ready to fight.
So tell me the story about one of the fights you got into.
You mean in the pros?
Yeah.
Oh, so many. I don't even know. There are so many, you know. Because there was one in the final game against the Lakers. This was in the playoffs, the final game against Kupchak. And the game plan, I was averaging about 38 points that series. And the game plan was to put a guy on me that will frustrate me, so I will fight. So the referee can kick both of us out of the game. So they put him on me, and they were successful because he came to tackle me. And I have a very little tolerance, no patience. So I, you know, just started swinging, you know, fighting. The referee the referee kicked both of us out of the game. That was in the second quarter of the game, which was very devastating for my team. But fortunately, we won that game in LA to go to the finals.
So how did you end up getting in less fights? Was it because of the stiffer penalties or because you just kind of learned the ropes better?
I think I established myself. And people know that you will fight. You have a little reputation. They know you will fight. So also they test it to the maximum, but they stop. They will not let you go, to cross the line, because they don't know if you will strike or not. So they still they respect you in that form. Where also I know that I have to be more tolerant. Mm-hmm. So I exercise a little bit more patience and more tolerance.
Are there aspects of the NBA that you feel you don't fit into?
In what way?
The culture of basketball, the values, the lifestyle. I don't mean the game itself. I mean all the stuff around the game.
Well, it depends on the individual. And to be successful, there's no other way around it, is to be God-conscious. That we've been given this opportunity, to make a living and to be a positive role model for the youths and for the American audience. And we should make a positive contribution to the society so we can use that as an advantage, if you understand the whole total picture, to use your position to help other people to understand that you can be in the position of power, but you humble yourself to be a good role model. So we have an opportunity to do something that is, unique and is positive. And if you don't understand it and you don't have control and discipline, then that money and the position will go towards destruction. You destroy yourself, your family, and it's, you'll be an example, a bad example for the audience. So you have a choice of being a good example or a bad example.
My guest is Hakeem Olajuwon. He has a new autobiography called Living the Dream. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nigerian-born basketball star Hakeem Olajuwon of the Houston Rockets. When you were growing up in Nigeria, you say that religion, you thought of religion as being for old people, but your set was not into religion, although your parents were devout Muslims. But you rededicated yourself to Islam about 5 years ago. How did that come about?
Well, growing up in Nigeria was a wonderful experience because we loved to play. We love watching American Soul Train basketball. We love the Western civilization. Really, was the core of my generation, and the traditional people at home were devout to the religion. Especially the Muslims. They pray 5 times a day, and I see my parents in a constant prayer. So I said to myself, this is a difficult religion. How can I be that patient and be that devout? So I couldn't picture myself in any form to have that much patience and tolerance to stay, to pray that much, and also to go with all the ritual that it's a way of life. So I witnessed this lifestyle. But my parents, they did not enforce the religion on the children.
Mm-hmm.
They enforced more of the principles as morality to the kids, that rather than the religion itself. So all the kids coming to America, the devout Muslims look at them as they lost, because once they go to America, that is when they come back home, the religion becomes something that, uncivilized. That is the way they look at it. But coming to America after I've been here for about 9 years or 8 years, and I know how I grew up. I know that I wanted to do much more. I wanted to be grateful. I wanted to be thankful, to God, because I know, because I went away from the religion, but I have the presence, God's presence in my heart, where that's what keeps me to do the right thing and to be humble and to be respectful and just to do the right thing, So I have that in me, but really not without knowledge. And a few group of people that came up to me were from the Nation of Islam. But once I listen to them and I see where they were talking about the race issue, and I know this is totally against Islam, because I know the basic principles of Islam from home. So I did not want to associate myself with them right away. So,
So you weren't interested in the Nation of Islam?
no, right away, because I know that that wasn't Islam. Islam is, it's universal. It's for all people. It's for mankind. And so I stayed away from them, and for a long time. So that was really a setback for me, until I found a mosque not too far from the summit where we play basketball, about 3 minutes away. And I was concerned not to go to the wrong mosque to be united with just on a racial group. But when I got there, I saw people from different background, and this really gave me the feel at home. I was very comfortable, and I heard the call to prayer, which, this was one of my favorite, growing up. So all these senses came back to me, and I was so happy, so rejoiced to rediscover Islam. But that was an advantage for me to learn Islam here, because at home they mix Islam and culture together. So you don't know what is culture and what is Islam. But learning Islam here in America, you learn by the book purely just Islam, not the culture. So it was an advantage for me.
Are you a star in Nigeria?
I would think so. Because just not in Africa, being an African, that African born that came to the United States, that rise to the stardom, and give a lot of people in Africa a lot of hope that they can also do it. And make basketball even much more popular in Africa. So that name was recognized everywhere in Africa.
Oh, just one more thing. Is it true that you sent your parents, or that you paid for your parents to have a satellite dish so that they could watch your games?
Of course, it's my duty.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Hakeem Olajuwon has a new autobiography called Living the Dream. Tonight, his team, the Houston Rockets, plays their third game against the Los Angeles Lakers in the NBA playoffs. The population of the so-called 500-channel cable TV universe rises by one tonight as Nickelodeon's Nick at Nite launches its new 24-hour sister service, Nick at Nite's TV Land. Most local cable companies aren't carrying TV Land, but cable subscribers who get Nickelodeon can watch tonight's special simulcast. TV critic David Bianculli explains how and has a review.
If you can get Nick at Nite on your TV set, you can get tonight's TV Land launch, too. Just turn to Nick at Nite at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, and presto. For one night, you'll be in TV Land. Nickelodeon is simulcasting TV Land in hopes that a lot of people will watch it tonight and call their cable companies tomorrow. If you love vintage TV, chances are you'll do both. TV Land has taken the slogan from Nick at Nite, preserving our television heritage, and turned it into an entire nonstop network. Just listen to what you get tonight in one night of TV Land. You get the original pilot of Happy Days, the one that was shown on Love American Style. You get the very first Addams Family, the very first Gunsmoke. You know how old that is? I do. It's from 1955, 41 years ago. You get the first episode of That Girl, the first Hogan's Heroes, the first Green Acres, and the first episodes of two Private Eye series that haven't been seen in quite a while. Mannix, in which Mike Connors got beat up a lot, and Honey West, in which Anne Francis had an ocelot. Tonight's all-night launch party also features the first episodes of Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere, which TV Land will run in sequence. Not that that'll help people who can't get the channel tomorrow. Also tonight, the Beatles' first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show, and Ronald Reagan as a guest star on the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour. And along with all that, a sitcom and a theme song you probably haven't thought of in a long, long time.
Come and ride the little train that is rolling down the tracks to the junction. Forget about your cares, it is time to relax at the junction. Lots of curves, you bet. Even more when you get to the junction.
Petticoat Junction.
But wait, that's not all. The biggest treat on TV Land tonight is a drama called Time Element, which originally appeared on Westinghouse Desilu Playhouse in 1958. It was written by Rod Serling, and it's a time travel story that served as the original unofficial pilot for The Twilight Zone. That's TV history of the best kind. And TV Land gives equal time to TV history of the worst kind. That's why tonight's all-night simulcast also includes the 1965 pilot episode of one of the most famously bad sitcoms of all time, My Mother the Car, starring Jerry Van Dyke. How could TV Land be any more fun than this? Here's how. For its first year of operation, because it's in so few TV homes anyway, TV Land isn't going to show any commercials. Not any new ones. Instead, it's showing vintage commercials along with its vintage programs. And during commercial breaks, you can see Speedy Alka-Seltzer, Punchy the Hawaiian Punch Guy, Charlie the Tuna, and other classic TV ad characters.
Once upon a time there was an engineer.
Choo-choo Charlie was his name, we hear.
He had an engine and he sure had fun. He used good and plenty candy to make his train run.
Charlie says, love my good and plenty. Charlie says, really rings the bell. Charlie says, love my good and plenty. Don't know any other candy that I love so well.
What else can I say? If TV Land was a real place, I'd move there. Stack up some blank cassettes and catch TV Land tonight, then get on the phones and start lobbying for it tomorrow.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A recent survey of America's largest corporations found that the pay of CEOs has increased at a rate 7 times that of the American worker. Coming up, we'll talk with Grafe Crystal, the compensation expert who conducted the survey, and with economist Ira Kay, who advises companies on how much to pay their CEOs. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the language of downsizing. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Workers' salaries may be stagnating, but CEOs are doing pretty good, according to a new study by my guest, Grafe Crystal. He examined the pay packages of CEOs heading 356 of America's top 500 corporations. He found that the average compensation package for a CEO is $4.5 million. As a former compensation consultant, Crystal used to help put together these packages. Now he's become a critic of the system. He says many CEOs are getting more than they're worth and more than is fair. His new study finds that the gap is expanding between the salaries of workers and CEOs.
In this last year, in looking at 222 of these 356 CEOs who had been in their jobs since at least 92, I tracked their movement in pay. And last year, the average CEO among that group increased his pay, and I say his because there are no women, increased his pay by 20.7%, a rate about seven times that of the increase for the average American worker, which was 2.8%. So in effect, the CEOs lapped the field 7.5 times or so on the workers. You wouldn't think they would have legs that strong given their age and expanding waistlines, but when it comes to a pay raise, you better watch out.
What is the average CEO package like now in the companies that you studied?
You have basically three elements to the pay package. You have base salary. The salaries have been rising at a reasonable rate. It's still much higher than the workers. The average salary in this group rose 6.5% last year, about twice the rate of an American worker. And then you have a bonus for annual performance. And, of course, times have been pretty good to companies in the last few years, so the bonuses have been rising. And if you add the salary and the bonus together, that's the cash compensation. That rose about 13%, and that would be, three and a half times the pay of an American worker. But where the big action is in what are called long-term incentives, and most specifically stock options, where we just have these huge grants being made, which sets in train huge pay later on.
Explain what stock options are.
Well, and let's assume today the market price is $50 a share on the New York Stock Exchange, and I come to you and I say, look, I'm going to give you an option on, we'll say, 1,000 shares today. And what I'm saying to you is, over the next 10 years, you have the right, but you don't have the obligation, to purchase those shares at $50 a piece. So if the stock goes up, let's say, to $100 a share, you can step forward and say, today's the day, here's my check for $50,000, $50 a piece times 1,000 shares, and in turn, you're going to give me back 1,000 shares of stock, which are worth $100,000, and I can sell them instantly and reap the $50,000 profit. But of course, if the stock goes down from 50, say, to 25, remember, I have the right but not the obligation to purchase them, so I just don't purchase them. And so I don't make anything, but I don't lose anything either.
Now, what is the reason that stock options are playing such a big part in CEO pay packages now?
Well, there are two reasons, I think, that you might cite. One is that there are a lot of people who believe they're very motivational, that with a stock option, somebody will mind the store better, they will be more motivated to take actions to increase the stock price and hence the total returns to the shareholders. That's one answer. Another answer of equally compelling force is the fact that the accountants have been holding a sale on stock options ever since 1950, when stock options first were introduced. And by that I mean that, for example, let me talk for a second about Michael Eisner at Disney. In 1992, he exercised a stock option on a single day and made a profit of $202 million. Now, had Disney given him a bonus of $202 million, he wrote a check for cash, the pre-tax profits of Disney would have to be lowered by $202 million because that's an expense. But because he got the money through the exercise of a stock option and because of a quirk in the accounting regulations, there was not one cent charged to Disney's earnings. And because of that, a lot of boards of directors seem to think that stock options are almost costless, that they don't cost anything. And they give them out in just huge dosages, if you will.
Now, your basic point with this study is that you think CEOs are being overcompensated for their efforts. They're being overpaid, yes?
I do feel that way, yes.
What does it matter?
Well, I think in a narrow sense, it matters because you say, well, this is a cost of doing business, the paying a CEO. And so if we're going to have a cost that's higher than it should be, we're going to have to handle that either by raising prices, so consumers will pay, you know, an extra penny for their Coca-Cola or whatever, or alternatively, we're going to have to cut profits, and the shareholders will take less, but something has to give. But I don't want to push that too far because, with the exception of perhaps these $65 million pay packages, some of these other pay packages are not so large in the context of the whole company's multi-billion revenue stream and profit stream as to make a great difference. But I think there's another reason that's perhaps deeper here, and that is that we have a democracy here. I think most Americans feel that if you accomplish more, you should be paid more. That it's not a case that we're communists. We want everybody to be paid the same. But when we see this tremendously yawning chasm where, like, say, in the early 70s, based on some not sketchy research I did, I don't want to put a heavy weight on it, but it would appear that the average American CEO of a major company was earning about 40 times the pay of a worker. And now it's about 225 times the pay. And we have this widening gap. And ironically, you know, taxes have been reduced during this period. So the take-home pay of the CEO has gone up much more than that ratio of 40 to 225 would suggest. And I think that can destabilize our society because we have to have a strong middle class for a democracy to survive.
Griff Crystal is a compensation expert who completed a new study of CEO pay packages. Coming up, a compensation consultant with a different point of view. This is Fresh Air. Ira Kay has helped large corporations put together their CEO compensation packages. He's the director of compensation consulting for the management consulting firm Watson Wyatt. When I asked him if he thinks CEOs are getting more than they're worth, he said it's a complicated social and economic question, and the answer isn't simple, but CEOs are truly important.
They create enormous amounts of value for their shareholders, and ultimately, those shares are owned by the mutual funds and the pension funds. So if, in fact, they are successful at creating that value, I believe that one could argue that they're worth it. Now, I think the important question that the board of directors and the shareholders need to ask is that if you're paying someone $50 million or $100 million, would they have done as good a job for half that amount? And I think the answer to that is probably yes, but as a board starts out in setting the compensation opportunities, and it is always opportunities, you know, it isn't a guarantee. This is not salary that we're talking about. This is typically a stock option, and the stock option only has value if the stock price rises. So if the board is trying to motivate their top management, not just the chief executive officer, if they're trying to motivate that top executive to increase the value of the company, they never know precisely how much to dangle in front of them. So sometimes they get it right, and sometimes they probably are more generous than they intended to be.
So the idea is that if you give a CEO a large salary and a lot of stock options, that they will have the incentive to do a better job.
Yes, I think that we learned very painfully, I think, in the mid and late 80s, that a lot of chief executive officers were really not being paid for performance. That while many were being paid for performance, a lot were not being paid for performance. And under severe pressure from institutional investors, particularly the pension funds and the public employee pension funds, the firemen pension funds and New York State employee pension funds, many, many companies changed the way they paid their chief executives and all of their top executives. And they put much more pay at risk. They have clearly slowed down their salaries. They still are very large salaries, but they clearly slowed down their salaries. And they put much more of their compensation opportunity into stock and stock options. And since that was the motivation, that was the carrot in front of these top executives, they really undertook those strategies to try to drive up those stock prices. And they were successful.
Yeah, I mean, one way of looking at this is to say that, the stock market has gone up so much in the past couple of years that this strategy has really been successful. The CEOs must really be motivated because the companies sure are doing well in the market. Is that the way you see it?
That is the way I see it. I think that there are many factors that explain why the United States stock market has done so well, effectively doubling over the last half a dozen or so years. And I think that those factors are the U.S. capital markets, our productivity increases, and so on. But I also think one of the secrets of that success in the stock market is the way that we pay our top management, and that they are highly motivated, economically motivated, financially motivated, to get those strategies right. And there are a lot of aspects to those strategies. They need to get their pricing right, you know, the price of their products. They need to get their research and development right. They need to make sure that they've got the right sales force, and they also need to make sure that the companies are the right size. They don't want to have too many employees because that's not good for the company and the shareholders, and it's also not good for the rest of the employees.
Another way of looking at the rise in the stock market is this. It's to say that there's so much more money invested in the market now as a result of this huge baby boom population having a lot of their money tied up in the market through mutual funds, because for the baby boomers, the equivalent of a pension fund is retirement money placed in a mutual fund. And all of this money is into the market, and that's boosting the market. So you could say that it's factors unrelated to the CEO's performance that has caused the market to rise so much. But the CEOs are really benefiting because they have stock options.
I would say that that's possible, but not likely. In my opinion, when you invest in your mutual funds, or you invest in your 401k, or you invest indirectly through your defined benefit pension plan, your investments can go into lots of different investments. They can go into money markets, they can go into bonds, and they can go into equities, you know, the stock market. And the fundamental question is, I think there are $6 trillion in equity assets in the United States right now. That the total of the stock market's worth around $6 trillion, and around half of that is owned by the mutual funds and the pension funds and so on. And it doesn't have to be. It could have been a third, or it could have been a quarter, or it could have been 10%. And I think that one of the reasons that the equity funds are so attractive is because people think that these companies are very well run. To really answer that question, I think you have to look on an international level. And I think Japan, I don't know as much about the demographics of Japan as the United States, but Japan also has tremendous population growth. They have, you know, a lot of people who are in the same kind of situation as the baby boomers, and they have tremendous savings rates. So they also have a lot of money that goes potentially into investments, and their stock market has halved. And, you know, there could be dozens of reasons why the Japanese stock market has declined by 50% over the last 6 years. I think one of the reasons is that their executives, their top management, is not motivated to undertake the difficult decisions that it takes to run these very complicated companies. And that's one of the reasons why they have not creeped out very effectively from the 1991 and 1992 recession.
I think a question a lot of people have is this: why is it that motivating CEOs is so important, that we're giving them millions of dollars in salary and benefits packages? What about the motivation of the people underneath them? And what about the motivation of the workers in a corporation? I mean, the CEO's rise in compensation packages is happening against a backdrop of enormous layoffs around the country, wages that aren't going up very much.
this is, again, a very complex issue, and it's something that I personally worry about a great deal as an advisor to American corporations. However, I think that there is a lot of sharing that is going on. The Watson Wyatt research that we do shows that more and more companies are, in fact, putting broad-based employee stock option programs in. They are putting in broad-based profit sharing and incentive, gain sharing and profit sharing types of programs in for all of their employees. And they continue to have very, the large corporations certainly tend to have very generous or certainly competitive benefits programs, pensions, and so on. And to the extent that many of those assets, 401k in particular, but the pensions and the profit sharing are invested in American, in the stock, either of their own company or of broadly of American companies, those assets have done very well. To the extent that there are others who are clearly not participating in this, that is a very significant social problem that I really don't know the answer to that. But I think that taking away the motivation from top management and all employees from really making their companies perform better is not the solution. I think that this issue about the layoffs is a very important one, and because it has such profound impact on people as individuals. But I think at the aggregate level, at the total level, even though millions of jobs have been eliminated through layoffs and whatever, even more jobs have been created. And I think that's why our unemployment rate is relatively low. Our unemployment rate in America is around 5.7%. Lower than France, lower than Germany, lower than Italy, lower than England, and lower than Canada. And we have a very robust labor market that really is in a position to absorb those people who are laid off and to continue the economic growth.
Is it really competitive when a big corporation is looking for a new CEO? Do they often have to outbid somebody else? And is it like a bidding war?
I know people find this hard to believe, but the answer is yes. All of the famous turnarounds that have been occurring in America in the last few years, Sears and IBM and American Express and Goodyear and Allied Signal and on and on and on, all of those companies were willing to pay a great deal of money for a chief executive officer, Scott Paper being another one. And basically what the board felt was that there was $3 billion, $5 billion, or $10 billion in market value potential. In other words, if the companies were worth $1 billion, it could go to $5 billion. If it was worth $5 billion, it could go to $10 billion because these were damaged companies. And the board basically felt that if you spent 0.1% of that increase, $5 million or $10 million, a tremendous amount of money to us as regular people, but not a lot of money relative to the value that can be created for the shareholders. And so it's a fairly, and they won't come, and the executives won't, they really won't come. I know Mr. Crystal says otherwise, that you could pay less, but as far as I can tell, the boards are highly motivated to pay less. There's tremendous amounts of discussions at that level saying, this is so much more than we paid the previous chief executive officer and so on, and they would like to pay less. And they're in a situation where the potential employees know the leverage that they have, that this is a tremendous upside situation. And for a fraction of a percentage of the value created, the board can look like heroes. And those boards do look like heroes. The board of IBM and Sears and American Express and so on and so on, and Allied Signal, they look like heroes because those companies have performed so well under, new kinds of opportunities.
Do you ever fantasize what it would be like to make quite as much as the CEOs whose salaries you help design?
The answer is no, because that job is as glamorous as it looks, and the pay is terrific. It is a very, very difficult job. It's obviously nowhere near as hard as being president of the United States, but when someone, they go in and they look 40 when they're starting at their presidential term, and then when 4 years later, they look 100.
Right.
It is extremely aggravating. I think people underestimate how difficult it is to make those hard decisions. Now, are they properly paid? They're very well paid. The other very important thing is that if when they lose their jobs, they almost never find work again. You know, if they get fired, and around, you know, 10 or 20% of major companies' chief executive officers do indeed get fired every year, and they basically never work again. If you look at all the CEOs of those companies that I mentioned before, I don't think any of them work.
No one wants to touch them?
Right, and, you know, they're tainted. And I think it's a very difficult job with tremendous responsibility, and they have very limited personal lives. You know, they work 6 or 7 days a week, and I think it's a very well-paid job. There's no question about it, but I think it has its unpleasant aspects as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ira Kay is the director of compensation consulting for the management consultant firm Watson Wyatt. Coming up, corporate euphemisms for the downsizing era. This is Fresh Air. A couple of years ago, our linguist Jeff Nunberg did a piece for us on the euphemisms that corporations were using to describe the elimination of jobs, like the word downsizing. Now that we appear to be in the downsizing era, we asked Jeff for an update on corporate euphemisms.
Mr. Dithers could allow himself the luxury of directness. Bumstead, you're fired. But nowadays, the axe is so muffled you can barely hear it fall. One Silicon Valley firm announced involuntary force reductions, while at Digital Equipment, the process was described as involuntary methodologies. Tandem Computers did focused reductions. And a while ago, Sun Oil said they were managing down their staff resources. Bumstead, you're managed down. Ideally, though, corporations prefer to describe the process as a kind of fitness regime for the body corporate rather than focusing on its effects on the individual cells. Companies are restructured, re-engineered, redeployed, right-shaped, and, of course, downsized. Ramada Inns has been streamlining. National Semiconductor tried reshaping. Lean is a favorite word here, a new leaner Sears. It's a good choice. It makes me think of Scottie Pippen driving the line rather than some anorexic with a distorted body image. Of course, there have always been lots of synonyms for dismiss. Mostly, though, they've been the graveyard humor that's coined by the people who suffer the effects of the boot. Maybe that's why they're always used in the passive. You get canned, get axed, get the boot, get the sack. That one goes back to the 17th century. Fired itself dates from the late 19th century. It's a pun on discharged, as in, the gun was discharged, the gun was fired. As best I can tell, though, people didn't really start to euphemize the process until the 1930s or so, when the expression let go seems to have made its first appearance. This was the first of these phrases to take the employer's point of view. That's why it's always used with have to, as in, we're going to have to let you go, Carruthers. It puts you in mind of a songbird scraping at the door of his cage. But it wasn't until a few years ago that corporate spokespersons really began to exercise their ingenuity here. When you hear a euphemism, you can be pretty sure that there's a sense of shame lurking somewhere just out of sight. And maybe that's really the new element here. Losing your job has always been a cause for anger and fear, but it's only in recent times that people have come to think of it as somehow shameful, as if firing people is an assault not just on their livelihood, but on their identity as well. As management consultant Jack Lawrence put it, people are what they do nowadays because they're not sure what else to be. And of course, that's particularly true if they're the loyal middle managers who've been the most conspicuous victims of the latest rounds of downsizing. This, at least, is the message sent out by all those frantic corporate efforts to find new terms for the same old stories, as if to say, hey, we're not really doing this. And not surprisingly, this kind of talk has exacerbated the public indignation over the restructurings themselves. In the public eye, in fact, corporations have pretty much replaced the government as the chief perpetrators of doublespeak and jargon over the past 5 or 10 years, which is saying something. It's tempting to personalize the outrage about this sort of language. You want to think that it reflects a rising tide of insincerity and deviousness. But doublespeak isn't usually an individual transgression. It's what happens when the system itself begins to talk. If there's an invisible hand that manages the marketplace, there sometimes seems to be an invisible mouth that speaks for it. You can decide for yourself whether the current restructurings are implicit in the logic of the new global economy, along with all those stratospheric CEO compensation packages. But I'm certain that the publicists who coin all these euphemisms have no choice in the matter at all. It is unfortunate, it is regrettable, it could have been me. But it really is something that we would prefer not to dwell on, particularly with a stock analyst attending to every nuance of the press releases. Corporate language is exactly like the corporation itself. Both of them are fictions created in order to limit individual responsibility. That's what makes the modern corporation different from Mr. Dither's little office. It's nothing personal, and they're doing all they can to keep it that way.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music from Frank Lesser's satire of corporate life, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. This is Matthew Broderick.
How to apply for a job, how to advance from the mailroom, how to sit down at a desk, how to dictate memorandums, how to develop executive style, how to commute in a three-button suit with that weary executive smile. This book is all that I need. How to succeed. Lunch with, how to avoid petty friends, how to begin making contacts, how to walk into a conference room with an idea, brilliant business idea, that will make your expense account zero. This book is all that I need.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.